high latitudes and high altitudes, you are in the moderate range. This is the D2 minor range for radiation dose, and this does include prenatal passengers, so please take this into consideration in your flight plans. So the space weather this week isn't all that exciting, but we do have a little bit of activity going on. We're being hit right now by a second pocket of fast solar wind from a coronal hole that's rotated into the Earth's strike zone. As a matter of fact, we're going to be hit by this fast solar wind easily over the
Hey, my name is Legacy from the Perfect 10 Club, and you're listening to 90.7 WGXC ACRA.
Producer Throwing Snow draws inspiration and samples from nature, and we'll hear how random patterns can mesh together on the next Deep Threes. Plus music from Mark Borecka, Leslie Barber, and the Sound Carriers. Deep Threes, music beyond boundaries for a digital world.
Tune in to Deep Threes after the noon news on Monday at WGXC 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support has been provided by Dedicated Presentation Solutions. Allow DPS to turn your audiovisual how do I's into here's how you can's. Visit dedicatedpresentation.com or call 845-475-8465 for more information. Dedicated Presentation Solutions, your audiovisual partner.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Elizabeth Powell Leather Items of Craryville, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
One speeding ticket, Columbia County.
Columbia County, everybody gets speeding tickets. How else do they pay for the roads to get plowed in the winter?
I'm Tom Rowe in ACRA, and this is the WGXC News Update. Go to the WGXC Newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Carl Campanelli reports in the New York Post that Governor Kathy Hochul signed an executive order November 26th, the first COVID-19 action by the leader of New York in a long time. It comes as the state and the world face the emergence of the new Omicron coronavirus variant in South Africa. Hochul is ordering hospitals to postpone elective surgeries in hospitals at or below 10% of available staffed bed capacity, so there are enough hospital beds for the expected new cases. Quote, "We've taken extraordinary action to prevent the spread of COVID-19 and combat this pandemic. However, we continue to see warning signs of spikes this upcoming winter. And while the new Omicron variant has yet to be detected in New York State, it's coming," unquote, Hochul said. Quote, "In preparation, I am announcing urgent steps today to expand hospital capacity and help ensure our hospital systems can tackle any challenges posed by the pandemic as we head into the winter months. The vaccine remains one of our greatest weapons in fighting the pandemic, and I encourage every New Yorker to get vaccinated and get the booster if you're fully vaccinated," unquote. The new executive order goes into effect December 3rd. Read more about this story at the New York Post. Melanie Lukosovic is reporting for Capital Region Independent Media that district residents turned out November 17th in support of a salary increase for the teachers employed by the Ravenna Queemans Selkirk School District. The teachers have been working without a contract since June. Quote, "These teachers are here to invest in the future of our children. It is now your turn to help us invest in the future of our teachers," unquote, parent Jessica O'Connor said during the public comment portion of the meeting. Matthew Miller, president of the RCS Teachers Association and a district biology teacher, said, quote, "Our contract expired in June of this year, so we are without a contract right now, but we are trying to work towards a new one. We have been in negotiations since January. For most of the summer, we were at an impasse," unquote. Following months of no activity, the district, its Board of Education, and the union reopened talks last week.
second round of negotiations is expected in early December. Quote, we have another meeting coming up December 7th, unquote, Board of Education President Edward Reville said. Numerous parents went to the podium during the Board of Education meeting asking that the district agree to a pay hike, the major sticking point in the ongoing contract talks. Quote, we have amazing teachers in this district. If we do not show appreciation and pay them what they deserve, we will see more putting in resignation letters and going to other districts, unquote, parent Chelsea Hildebrandt said. Board President Revelle said, quote, none of us argue with any of you. We agree we do have great teachers, unquote. Read more about the story in the Ravenna News Herald. Nick Reisman is reporting for New York State of Politics that under legislation put forward by two state lawmakers on November 24th, local news organizations would be eligible for business tax credits to hire journalists, and subscribers would be eligible for a personal income tax credit. The tax credits are being proposed as local newspapers have come under economic strain and are increasingly under the control of hedge funds. For example, the hedge fund Alden Capital has reportedly sought the purchase of Lee Enterprises, a chain that publishes papers in Buffalo, Glens Falls, and St. Louis. Alden has come under fire for purchasing newspapers only to reduce staff and liquidate real estate. Quote, community news is the bedrock of our democracy, but since 2004, more than 20% of American newspapers have gone out of business, including 40% of weekly papers in New York, unquote, said State Senator Brad Holyman. He said the Local Journalism Sustainability Act provides a way to help local news outlets survive and continue to inform the public in the current media landscape. The tax credits would apply to local newspapers and digital publications as a way to support subscriptions and hiring. Under the measure, subscribers to local publications would receive an annual tax credit for 80% of the subscription costs in the first year and 50% in subsequent years, up to $250 a year. Local news organizations that employ local journalists full-time would be eligible for a quarterly tax credit of up to 50% of their salary for the first year and 30% in subsequent years for up to 5 years total. Read more about this story at NewYorkStateOfPolitics.com. Read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom, WGXC.org. The National Weather Service in Albany predicts Sunday there is a chance of snow showers before noon, a 40% chance. Then a slight chance of rain and snow showers until the afternoon with cloudy skies and a high of 35. Sunday night, mostly cloudy is in the forecast with another chance of snow, a 50% chance, with a low around 26. Monday, there is a slight chance of snow before 1 p.m. Then it turns partly sunny with a high of 34 and a low around 22. Tuesday is partly sunny with a high of 37 and a low around 27. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, radio for open ears. Mid-Hudson Valley Democratic Socialists are hosting a Meet the Labor Movement in the Hudson Valley Zoom event on Tuesday, December 7th, with local union representatives including Beth Wilson, Brian Nelson, Sarah Dowd, Ashwini Sukanthankar, and others. There's RSVP online. It's one of the many events in the community calendar at WGXC.org. You can find out more information there about the Meet the Labor Movement event, Tuesday, December 7th, online from the Mid-Hudson Valley Democratic Socialists.
Welcome, radio listeners. You're listening to Bound by Books, Youth Radio on WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson. Listener-supported radio for open ears. I'm Emily. I'm the director of the Hudson Area Library. And I'm from Hudson.
And I'm not Georgia, the real director of the Hudson Area Library. And I'm not from near Hudson. And I'm not 10 years old. 11 yes. years old? 10 years. I'm not 10 years old.
I'll be not 11 years old in on February 18th. But until then, I'm not 10 years old.
Oh, God, do we have to tell how old we are?
No.
I'm Nancy, and I'm Emily's mom. And I'm here for Thanksgiving with Emily. I'm from New Hampshire, where Emily grew up. And I have a birthday coming up. I'm going to be 75.
We talk about books here every week. Books we love, books we hate, and
bookish things.
Oh, by the way, I'm actually Georgia for new radio listeners. And
yeah, Georgia likes to pretend she's me.
Yes.
Emily.
And I am not the director of the Hudson Area Library, and I am 10.
But yeah, we're excited to have my mom, Nancy, here today to talk about some books. What she didn't tell everyone is that she's a retired high school librarian. So she's yeah. read a lot of books and a lot of books for young people too. And she's worked with young people for a long time. So champion.
Actually, I'd love to tell you about a couple of books that I just read this month. And they're adult books, but they have teenage protagonists in them. And so I think they're books that teenage readers would really like, although they're long. I think they're both over 600 pages long. But if it's a good story, a long story is good. You know, like Harry Potter, people who like Harry Potter, you know, those books got longer and longer and longer, but the people who loved them didn't care that they were, you know, really long. So this is my favorite time of year for books because publishers tend to put out their best books right before the holiday shopping period. So this is the time of year when some of the best books of the year come out. And the two books that I read this month both came out, and they're both by authors I had read before. One is called Lincoln Highway, and it's by Amor Towles, who wrote a very popular book for adults called Gentleman from Moscow. And that one I wouldn't recommend to teenagers. But Lincoln Highway is about four boys, three of them teenagers, and one of them a younger brother of one of the boys who's eight and a super smart eight-year-old. And it's about their trip from Nebraska to New York City as each of them is looking for a better life. And the problem is that their definitions of what will make a better life differ. And Amor Towles is really a storyteller. You really get involved in the stories of these boys. And, you know, it's really a terrific read. Other book that I would like to tell you about is called Cloud Cuckoo Land. And this one is by Anthony Doerr, who wrote All the Light You Cannot See, which was a wildly popular adult book. And this one has characters from the past, the present, and the future. In the past, they're in the early 15th century. There are two young people. One is an orphan, and one is a young guy who has a team of oxen. And they're in Constantinople during the siege of Constantinople. And the present day story focuses on a kid named Seymour, who becomes an eco-terrorist when his beloved owl, a wild owl that he's been watching for some time, is killed by people cutting down trees. And a man named Zeno, who lives in the town and is an elderly man. And then in the future, there's a girl named Constance, who I think is a tween. And she's on a spaceship hurtling to a distant planet after the destruction of Earth. And she knows that she will not live to see the planet that they're headed to, that her life will be on this spaceship. And it's what happens when things go wrong on the spaceship. But what ties them all together is a story about a guy named Aegon, who is searching for a better place to live in the sky called Cloud Cuckoo Land. And so it's really a book about books and stories and libraries. And I think people who love to read would really love reading this book.
I like the idea of a place called Cloud Cuckoo Land.
Yeah.
I would like to go there.
Yeah.
I was wondering if the first book, because you mentioned there's multiple characters that you're kind of following throughout the story, is it told from their perspectives or...
Well, it's interesting because some of them are and some of them are in the third person. I did notice that difference. But the two of the boys have grown up on a failing farm in Nebraska. And the one boy accidentally is responsible for the death of another boy. And he's been sent to a juvenile detention place. And while he's there, his father dies. His mother has already taken off and left them years before. And his little brother is super smart, but they decide that they're going to go seek a new life. And the younger brother wants to go to San Francisco because that's where he's determined that that's where their mother is. And he wants to go find their mother. The other two boys sneak out of they don't get released from this detention facility. The other two boys hide in the warden's car when the warden is driving the boy who served his time back to his family farm. And they also have an agenda, what they want to do. And they end up on going to New York City, which is the start of the Lincoln Highway, which was the first highway in the United States to cross from the East Coast to the West Coast. So the younger brother wants to follow the Lincoln Highway and follow the postcards that his mother sent them after she left them. So that's how what the title of the book means. The Lincoln Highway starts in Times Square and goes to San Francisco.
Sounds fun. I like a good road trip
book. Yeah, well, it's both stories are told by authors who are storytellers. I mean, that these are engaging stories that you just really want to find out what's going to happen. So even though they're both long, when you get to the end, you kind of go, oh, you know, though they both have satisfying endings. Mm-hmm. And Crowd Cuckoo Land, which seems to be in so many different directions, actually, you know, kind of comes together, you know, at the end. So I recommend them both to people who are avid readers who, you know, want to try an adult book.
Yeah, I'll have to give those a go.
Yeah, for sure you should. So, Georgia, what have you been reading?
Well, I do have one question.
Oh, sure.
About the book. Is it for adults because of, like, the length, or is it because of the content?
Well, I think the length is part of it. And I think it's because the authors are authors of adult books. I don't think they were aiming this at a younger audience. And yet I know that when I was a teenager, I frequently read adult books. And I think that these two adult books are probably better suited than most adult books for teenagers because of the characters who are young. And in fact, at one point when I was reading Lincoln Highway, I wondered if the young characters would be off-putting to some adult readers. It wasn't for me at all. I love the books. But I wondered how some adult readers would read it. Did that answer your question satisfactorily?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Yeah.
So I just got this book and I finished it. I nonstop read it for 1 3/4 of a day. I pretty much just only took breaks for necessary things like eating, and yeah, you guys know the rest. For eating and all that, and walking and school, but I didn't have school on those days, so.
What's the book? I couldn't see the title.
So the book is Tangled Up in Luck by Merrill Wyatt, and this is my new favorite book. I feel like if I try to describe it, I'm going to spoil it all. I don't do too good of a job of describing books without spoiling everything or giving too little information. There are two descriptions, one inside cover and the back, so I'll just read both. Warning, it's lengthy. It all began with the mystery of the long-lost Hall jewels. Someone had stumbled across the forgotten fact that the jewels even existed, that someone wanted very badly to find them. By using the seventh grade to uncover hidden clues, what that person never counted on was two of those seventh graders playing all the clues together. That person never expected a couple of kids to try to get the jewels first. $13 million can motivate some people to do all sorts of dreadful things. And the inside says, if you told Sloane Osborne and Amelia Miller Poe that they'd be hiding from an evil mastermind in their town cemetery, they wouldn't have believed you. If you said that person was intent on beating them to a coach of long-lost jewels, they'd have been sure you got your facts wrong. Finally, if you told them they'd be doing all this as friends, well, they would have been sure you needed medical attention. Whether through serendipity, really, really good luck, or zimblanity, really, really bad luck, someone tricked their teacher into using the seventh grade class to investigate the mystery of their town's long-missing treasure. Now things have escalated, and the girls are stuck hiding behind a gravestone just a few clues short of those jewels. It's up to these enemies turn partners to uncover these century-old clues, to find the treasure at the end of this book before their before the shadowy person on their trail can get to it first. And this book is definitely, most definitely a middle grade novel, but I think that some teenagers might like this. This is 238 pages.
So are the characters boys or girls or both?
So they are female.
Ah, nice.
And I personally like Amelia more. I'm similar to Amelia.
In what ways?
Well, Amelia's sort of a dreamer, and she really daydreams and likes making up stories and dressing up. And Sloane's all like sporty and the, you know, cool girl who's friends with the mean girl. And no, well, you don't know. Ha 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 ha. I always say, you know, but then I realize, oh, wait, people don't know what I'm talking about. Ha 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 ha. So, yeah.
So you said this is your new favorite book. What is it about the book that makes it your new favorite?
Well, you know that feeling where you're reading a longer book, and this is a longer book. The amount of pages doesn't seem like very much, but they're long pages. So when I was reading the book, I was just like, come on, come on, get to the end. It's so exciting. And then once I got to the end, I was like, oh. So I hope that they make a sequel, because it seems like they're going to make a sequel because they kind of started a detective agency at the end.
Ooh, so you think this might be a series, huh?
I'm thinking. Wow. Though this was recently made, so I think that it might become a series or not.
Was it published this year?
Yes.
Cool.
So, sounds really
does
fun.
Does the Hudson Area Library have it?
I'm not sure.
Do not know.
Well, but you need to check, because it sounds like a book they should have if they don't.
I definitely need to get it now that I know it's George's favorite book.
Thank
and
you.
I can be like, you need to read this. It's somebody's favorite book.
So this is, I'd say this is supposed to be a middle grade novel, but I feel like it also intrigued those like 8 years plus.
I think that the fact that the characters are in the seventh grade probably means that seventh grade is, you know, right in the middle. Yeah.
Yeah. But then also I feel like some adults might like it. So
oh,
I feel
yeah.
like this is pretty much seven plus. I'd say it's got a pretty wide age range. I mean, if a seven-year-old with a very advanced reading level, I bet that they could read this. So yeah, that's my book.
Sounds good.
So I'm actually not going to share a book this week, but I'm going to share some poems from poets.org in honor of American Indian and Alaska Native Heritage Month. And so I picked out a few that I can read. And so the first one is called Carrying Our Words by Ofelia Zepeda. And this is a pretty short one. And it was translated into English from Oodham. So Ofelia Zepeda is a member of the Tohono O'odham Nation of Southwestern Arizona. And she's the author of three poetry collections. So this one is called Carrying Our Words. We travel carrying our words. We arrive at the ocean. With our words, we are able to speak of the sounds of thunderous waves. We speak of how majestic it is, of the ocean power that gifts us songs. We sing of our respect and call it our relative.
It's interesting that she lives in southwestern Arizona and is writing about the ocean, because Arizona isn't near the ocean. Interesting.
But she does say we travel carrying our words and we arrive at the ocean.
That's so true. I wonder if her tribe is noted for traveling. Oh.
So the next poem I chose is called Autumn, and it's by Alexander Posey. And I read a poem by Alexander Posey last week on the radio show as well. And he was born in 1873 and was a Muscogee Creek poet, journalist, and humorist. So this is Autumn. In the dreamy silence of the afternoon, a cloth of gold is woven over wood and prairie, and the jaybird, newly fallen from the heaven, scatters cordial greetings and the air is filled with scarlet leaves that, dropping, rise again as ever with a useless sigh for rest. And it is autumn. That poem appeared in the Poems of Alexander Lawrence Posey.
I did not realize that I was unmuted. I really thought I was muted. So at first I was like doing—
You're silent clapping? It's hard to silent clap.
Yeah, it is.
I like a good autumn poem before we head into the winter season. It's good to get those autumn poems in there. Celebrate the season. Enjoy the season.
'Tis the season to be jolly.
Hey, what kind of fall song is that? So I'm going to read one more poem, and this one is by Joy Harjo, who is the United States Poet Laureate. And she was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1951 and is a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation. And she has many books of poetry, memoirs, and of course her great Poet Laureate project, Living Nations, Living Words, which you can find online and access a map where you can read poems by different poets all over the country. And talked about it many times on the show, so I'm not going to go into more detail about that, but check it out, Living Nations, Living Words by Joy Harjo. And this poem is called Remember. Remember the sky that you were born under. Know each of the stars' stories. Remember the moon. Know who she is. Remember the sun's birth at dawn. That is the strongest point of time. Remember sundown and the giving away tonight. Remember your birth, how your mother struggled to give you form and breath. You are evidence of her life and her mother's and hers. Remember your father. He is your life also. Remember the earth whose skin you are. Red earth, black earth, yellow earth, white earth, brown earth. We are earth. Remember the plants, trees, animal life, who all have their tribes, their families, their histories too. Talk to them, listen to them. They are alive poems. Remember the wind, remember her voice. She knows the origin of this universe. Remember you are all people and all people are you. Remember you are this universe and this universe is you. Remember all is in motion, is growing, is you. Remember language comes from this. Remember the dance language is that life is. Remember. And that is from her collection called She Had Some Horses, which is another favorite poem of mine.
Also, by the way, on the first poem, I forgot to clap too, but that one's a clapper too. That one's, well,
three clappers.
Yeah, the first one, just I didn't come up with the idea to clap yet.
Yeah. I love the site poets.org. There's so many great poems to read on it. And you can look up things by theme. They have a poems for kids section, which is very useful if you host a youth radio show and want to share some poems that are appropriate for kids. And they also do like special commemorative lists of poems. So if you're looking for poems for a certain season or a holiday or Remembrance Day, you can find poems on there by theme. So highly suggest checking out poets.org and Living Nation, Living Words.
Speaking of themes and holidays, mm-hmm. I'm going to have a packed next month because I celebrate Jewish holidays and Christian holidays because actually I'm half and half. So I'm going to have Thanksgiving on the 25th, Hanukkah on the 28th, and then Christmas on the 25th. September, not November.
Yeah. Festive
so
time.
Full of fun stuff.
My mom also has a birthday coming up.
Emily's sister, Sarah, is part of a half and half family too. Her children are Jewish. And so they're looking forward to Hanukkah starting on Sunday. But she often gives her nephews a book a day for Hanukkah. That's been kind of her tradition. She's a reading specialist and an avid reader in her own right. And so she tends to give her nephews books for Hanukkah, you know, one for each of the 8 days.
Emily, books are in your blood. Maybe somebody literally maybe you got cut or something and somebody ripped up the pages of a book the book about all books in the world and then just stuffed it into your blood and then put a Band-Aid over it, sealed it up.
Could be.
This is my friend.
We have a new guest who has joined us.
Hi.
Hi, what's your name?
Molly.
Molly, nice to meet you. I think we've heard about you on the show before.
She talks about random people way too much.
Molly, don't embarrass me. This is going on radio.
Sorry.
So, Molly, do you have a favorite book or series or author?
I have a lot of favorite authors and favorite books.
Oh, wait. Isn't your very favorite Perseus Jackson?
No.
Really?
It's actually a little kid's book that I read on my dad's on vacation.
Oh, cool.
Actually, I don't remember the name of it because we haven't had to read it in a while.
The book without pictures?
Oh. It's My Daddy Loves Me.
That's sweet.
Also, Molly introduced me to the Percy Jackson series. Well, actually, technically, I read it first as a read aloud.
But I'm the one who got into it. I've read the whole series and all the series in the series, so I'm basically like the biggest Rick Riordan fan in the world.
I read the first book when I was 8 as a read aloud class, and I didn't really like it. Wait, no, when I was 6.
Didn't like it.
And I didn't like it at first.
Why didn't you like it?
Because I didn't. And then I reread it when I was 8 and liked it. And then I forgot about it. And then I came back to it recently.
And then I was like, read Percy Jackson.
I came back to it recently after 2 years of Molly bugging me.
We're interesting together.
It's true. I think I would have enjoyed that series when I was younger because I was really into mythology. As a kid, I don't remember what age of the kid I was when I was really into mythology, but I think I would have liked it.
Old Greek mythology person.
Yep, that's true.
Cool.
I was going to say nerd, but I didn't want.
I am a nerd. dork.
I didn't want to embarrass you.
I'm fine with it. I am a Greek mythology nerd. Dork.
There's worse things to be. Yeah, I think nerds are pretty great.
I am proud of being a nerd. I am a full-on nerd. I'd much rather be a nerd than a jerk.
Another one of my friends says that instead of being a geek or a nerd, she's a dork. I don't really see the difference between the three of them, but she does.
It's a subtle difference.
Well, I think that often geek or dork are used as negative terms. I mean, they're all used as negative terms, but nerd recently has been made into more of a positive term.
I feel like dork would be a cute nickname.
Yeah, I prefer
nerd. It sounds cute. Like the Dork Diaries.
Well, it was nice meeting you, Molly. And you're welcome to join us on a show another time if you want.
Very nice to meet you, too.
Yay. Well, we're just about out of time for today. But we hope everyone out there listening has a great week filled with lots of quality reading time. And we'll be back next week to talk about some more books.
Yay.
In the meantime, happy reading.
India Clara, your abuelo say, my tía she say, and the people say, mejor la raza. Your abuelo say, my tía she say, and the people say, mejor la raza. Pelo bueno, pelo malo, no te cases con fulano. Mary Fair, stay out of the sun. Bleach your skin, it's in the sun. Ay, 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 ay. Quemar looking like a blanquito. No me venga con tu cuento que tu abuelo era andaluz. No me venga con tu cuento que tu abuelo era andaluz. En la sangre caribeña hay taíno y negritud. En la sangre caribeña hay taíno y negritud. Pelo bueno, pelo malo.
You came out looking like a blanquita. Looking like a blanquita.
From the WGXE newsroom, this is the WGXE Daily News. I'm Philip Grant. Ted Remsnyder is reporting for Columbia Green Media. COVID-19 has claimed its 84th victim in Greene County. On Tuesday, November 23rd, a 39-year-old woman with severe comorbidities died after coming down with the coronavirus. The unidentified woman was unvaccinated at the time of her death, according to the Greene County Public Health Department. Greene County Administrator Sean Groden said no additional information was made available about the woman. As of Wednesday, 64% of adults in Greene County have received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. There are 221 active positive cases in the county, according to the Public Health Department, with 92 positive cases recorded since November 20th. A total of 350 county residents are under quarantine, with 20 people in the county hospitalized with 20 COVID-related illnesses. As of Tuesday, the total percentage of cases in the county with positive results was 9.9%. with a seven-day rolling positive average in Greene County of 4.6%. You can read that full story in HudsonValley360.com. Andrea Mako is reporting for Porcupine Soup. Interested parties turned out November 22nd for the first of two public hearings held at the former Durham Elementary School on the proposed Bosque subdivision. Approximately a dozen people spoke, the majority of them opposed to the project. Many of the speakers took issue with the town board's October decision to issue a negative declaration under the state environmental quality review, thereby finding that the 95-acre subdivision will have little to no environmental impact. Margaret Doherty spoke on behalf of the community group Cornwallville Residents for Rural Preservation, saying the project will have, and I quote, significant negative impact, end quote, on land, wells, traffic, noise, light, wildlife, aesthetic, and historical value and community character, end quote. Bosque Development of Hudson has submitted a proposal to the town of Durham to subdivide 95 acres of land that border Strong and Cornwallville roads. The project includes the construction of 12 high-end homes and a farming operation. Doherty said her organization over the past month has collected 271 signatures from Durham residents opposed to the subdivision. She told the board, and I quote, "We hope that as lead agency, you will finally address the concerns of the majority of our residents within the Cornwallville community," end quote. Patrick Saccone, chairman of the Durham Historic Preservation Commission, noted that the project footprint is larger than the core hamlet of Cornwallville. He said, and I quote, "and its area comprises a significant portion of the total area of the Cornwallville Historic District," end quote. Other speakers addressed issues ranging from traffic safety, light pollution, and noise. Cornwallville resident Jim Stone was the only person to speak in favor of Bosque. Stone said, and I quote, "There is a reason Durham is dying, because we won't allow change. Places that don't allow change, they die," end quote. A second public hearing will take place at 6 p.m. on December 11th in the former Durham Elementary School. The public may also attend remotely via telephone at 503-300-6830, conference code 114-503. And you can read more about this story at porcupinesoup.com.
Patricia R. Doxey is reporting for the Daily Freeman. The Ulster County Legislature's Ways and Means Committee adopted budget amendments this week that eliminated a number of positions created as part of County Executive Pat Ryan's proposed 2022 budget. The amendments rolled back proposed salary increases for others. Altogether, the committee made nearly two dozen changes to the proposed spending plan before voting to send it to the full legislature for consideration. While the resolution to eliminate the communications specialist position narrowly failed, the committee did agree to reduce that salary by roughly $20,000. Minority Leader Ken Ronk first argued to get rid of the position, claiming it is more, and I quote, brand building and self-promotion, end quote, for the executive than for communications with the public, end quote. The Walco Republican said, and I quote, I don't think this is a necessary position for county government, end quote. The committee also voted to reduce the administration of the American Rescue Plan funds. Legislature Chairman David Donaldson said he will propose eliminating those jobs from the budget if Ryan's office fails to provide the legislature with the resumes of those who have been hired to fill the positions. Deputy Budget Director Chris Kelly said the Ryan administration is aware of Donaldson's request and it is under review. The committee rejected a proposal by Ronk to eliminate the newly proposed Commissioner of Mental Health position, as well as a proposal to increase to full-time an existing part-time position in the Human Rights Commission. The full legislature will vote on the 2022 spending plan on November 2nd. And you can read the full story in the Daily Freeman. And that wraps up the WGXC Daily News. For local weather reports, public meetings, community information, or COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
As Thanksgiving turns 400, Indigenous resistance is rising. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Wampanoag, Massachusetts, Nipmuc, Mohegan, Pequot, Narragansett, Passamaquoddy, Mi'kmaq, these are just some of the Indigenous nations of the land now called New England, the home of that original Thanksgiving dinner that occurred 400 years ago in the fall of 1621. The myth of that shared meal has evolved over the centuries, depicting friendship and cooperation between the English settlers in Plymouth, Massachusetts, and the Wampanoag people, who'd been there for at least 10,000 years. While that gathering was peaceful, it was at best a token respite from the European settler colonist genocide against Native peoples that was already well underway. While families gather across the country for this year's Thanksgiving celebration, frontline Indigenous communities that have survived centuries of violence, displacement, and systemic racism remain in resistance, defending land, water, and their very existence. Those 100 or so early settlers, popularly referred to as pilgrims, arrived on Wampanoag territory in 1620. After the first winter, racked by disease and hunger, their number had dwindled to 54. Indigenous people came to their aid, teaching them how to cultivate local crops. By harvest time, the settlers managed to store enough food to survive the coming winter, so they organized a celebratory feast. The Wampanoag people had just suffered a multi-year plague that had decimated Native populations across the region, and historians believe sought a strategic partnership with the settlers. English King James I was encouraging colonization and even touted the benefits of the deadly contagion, calling it a wonderful plague in a 1620 proclamation, leading to, quote, the utter destruction, devastation, and depopulation of that whole territory, he said. That was the era that the late historian Bernard Bailyn, who died last year at the age of 97, described as the barbarous years, as the so-called pilgrims mounted increasingly savage massacres and military campaigns against those natives whose land they wanted. Later, leaders would couch the ongoing genocide in more diplomatic language with colonial initiatives like Manifest Destiny and the 1934 Indian Reorganization Act, that cemented the modern system of impoverished and neglected reservations. The Declaration of Independence lists among its grievances against King George III his encouragement of attacks against the colonists by, quote, merciless Indian savages, unquote. From 1777 through 1868, the United States signed at least 368 treaties with Native nations and violated every one. Canada's track record is comparable. Indigenous people have never stopped demanding that these treaties and their national sovereignty be honored. In the fall of 1969, a group of Native American activists occupied the abandoned federal prison on Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay, issuing a sarcastic manifesto demanding Alcatraz become a reservation as it bore all the hallmarks of one. It was isolated, had no running water, sanitation, access to education, health care, or employment, and its occupants would be treated like prisoners. The 19-month occupation involved thousands of people and inspired indigenous people across North America to demand justice. The American Indian Movement was founded, leading to the 1973 activist occupation of Wounded Knee on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, galvanizing international solidarity for indigenous rights. In 2016, indigenous resistance catapulted into global headlines as Lakota and Dakota people opposing construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline established resistance camps at Standing Rock. After DAPL's owner, Energy Transfer Partners, sicked dogs and beat Native water defenders, the camp swelled to over 10,000 people with over 200 indigenous nations and tribes represented. The pipeline was eventually built, but a new era of Native resistance had emerged. Now pipelines are being constructed to move the world's dirtiest fossil fuel, tar sands petroleum, in Western Canada. Indigenous-led resistance to Enbridge's Line 3 pipeline in northern Minnesota has been waged for years now. Anishinaabe leader Winona LaDuke has been on the front lines there. She criticized President Joe Biden's inaction on Line 3 and commented on the Democracy Now! NewsHour on Biden's appointment of the first Native American cabinet member in history, Interior Secretary Deb Haaland.
Joe, if you appoint Indian people, don't just make them pretty Indian people that sit in your administration. Let them do their job. Indigenous thinking is what we need in the colonial administration. That's when change happens.
In British Columbia, Canada, the Wet'suwet'en sovereign nation has been resisting the multi-billion dollar Coastal GasLink pipeline being constructed by TC Energy. Just this week, Canadian federal police raided a multi-month blockade, smashing into a cabin with an axe and a chainsaw and arresting the land defenders inside. Police then burned the cabin to the ground. This myth of that abundant shared meal 400 years ago continues to mask misery, from poverty and substance abuse to the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women. But Native communities are resilient and organized and rising up in resistance. For this, we should all give thanks. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
This is ARRL Audio News, your weekly summary of news highlights from the world of amateur radio. If you retransmit audio news through a repeater, listen for the Morse code K character, followed by 4 seconds of silence. That's your cue to stop transmitting so that your repeater timer can reset.
Hey, how you doing? I'm Rick Lindquist, WW1ME in Ellsworth, Maine, and this is ARRL Audio News for Friday, November 19th, 2021. Before we dive into the news, we have this note regarding the Thanksgiving holiday. ARRL headquarters will be closed on Thursday, November 25th, and Black Friday, November 26th for the Thanksgiving holiday. The ARRL letter will not be published on Thursday, November 25th, and this program, ARRL Audio News, will not be produced on Friday, November 26th. There will be no W1AW bulletin and code practice transmissions on either day. ARRL headquarters will reopen on Monday, November 29th at 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. And of course, ARRL wishes you a safe and enjoyable holiday. Okay, let's get down to the news. ARRL and the Orlando Amateur Radio Club will host the 2022 ARRL National Convention and Orlando Hamcation on February 10th through the 13th. The convention theme, Rediscover Radio, highlights radio amateurs' commitment to developing knowledge and skills in radio technology and radio communication. Convention organizer and ARRL Director of Public Relations and Innovation, Bob Inderbitzen, NQ1R, says there will be expert presenters, community building opportunities, and plenty of social time to celebrate being together with friends. And he adds, who doesn't love Florida in February? The convention will kick off on Thursday, February 10th, with a series of morning and afternoon training tracks and a national convention luncheon. Registration is now open for Thursday's program at www.arrl.org/expo, and an early bird registration rate of $75 is in effect through December 15th. The National Convention training tracks are workshops providing an in-depth learning experience in one of the four track topics. Contest University is one of them. That's a first for Orlando. There's also Emergency Communications Academy, a hands-on handbook workshop, and a Technology Academy. Russia tested an anti-satellite weapon on November 15th, destroying Cosmos 1408, one of its old and now defunct satellites, launched in 1982. Cosmos 1408 was some 300 miles above Earth. Its destruction generated a debris field in low Earth orbit that prompted the seven International Space Station crew members, including one Russian cosmonaut, to take cover in their crew capsules for several hours in case they had to abandon the station. NASA Chief Bill Nelson explained that this action was based on a risk assessment by the Debris Office and ballistics specialists at Johnson Space Center in Houston. Occupants of the Chinese space station are reported to have taken similar action. The incident also generated criticism from many corners, as well as a grave discussion on the possible impact of any future such tests by Russia or anyone else. The danger of damage to the ISS or an orbiting satellite aside, tracking a debris field that could include thousands of pieces in order to head off a collision is a concern all its own. AMSAT President Robert Bankston, KE4AL, said that Russia's action will pose a threat to all activities in low Earth orbit for years to come, placing satellites and human spaceflight missions at risk. As he explained, space is already crowded, but now there are at least 1,500 trackable fragments and possibly hundreds of thousands of smaller yet still threatening pieces of debris in low Earth orbit. Space stations can move out of the way, but most satellites cannot and face greater risk of catastrophe. Bankston said AMSAT is closely monitoring the situation and is hoping for the best. This is ARRL Audio News, heard in Cookeville, Tennessee, Tuesdays at 8:30 p.m. on the 147.21 repeater, courtesy of the Cookeville Repeater Association. Time now for the AMSAT report. A lot of new hams are venturing into amateur radio satellites. Whether you prefer CW, SSB, FM, or digital, there's a satellite to suit your tastes. Unlike solar flares and all other different layers of the atmosphere, satellite operators only have to worry about the satellite's footprint, its coverage on the face of the Earth. If you're in the footprint and the satellite elevation is high enough for your antennas to see it, you can work through that satellite. Satellite passes are short. They last anywhere from a few minutes if you're on the edge of a footprint to about 20 minutes if the satellite is passing directly overhead. Good starter satellites are the FM EasySats, which include some APRS satellites. The CWSSB satellites are a bit more challenging. To get answers to your questions, the AMSAT bulletin board is a wealth of knowledge. Someone there will be able to help you through the learning process. Go to amsat.org and click on Services to subscribe. And AMSAT wishes everyone a happy Thanksgiving. The AMSAT report comes to us each week, courtesy of Bruce Page, KK5DO. The Fairlawn, New Jersey Amateur Radio Club recently hosted a coffee talk with Larry Van Horn and 5FPW, an expert on monitoring military communications, including via satellite. Here's just a little bit of what he had to say.
There's sometimes some very interesting communications down in the what we call the Federal Military LMR, which is the land mobile radio low band frequencies from 30 to 50 megahertz, right below the 6 meter band. The primary mode that most of the military aircraft do use down there are going to be, believe it or not, FM. You may hear A-10 communications down there. You may hear aircraft on various bombing ranges around the country. You may hear aircraft from other places around the world. When the Iraq conflict broke out and we were sending armor into Iraq, this band was hot with tank activity. Some of it was in the clear, most of it was not, but it was still interesting to be able to know what was going on and just to be able to sort of take in what was going on over there. And we just so happened to be at a high end of the sunspot cycle. So we were getting some pretty good propagation out of the Middle East during that time frame.
Larry Van Horn, N5FPW, an expert on monitoring military communications, who spoke recently in a virtual presentation for the Fairlawn, New Jersey Amateur Radio Club. ARRL Audio News is heard in Lewisburg, Tennessee, Mondays at 6:45 p.m. on the 146-625 repeater, courtesy of the Marshall County Amateur Radio Society. Isn't it always the way? The big DX contest, and talking about the CQWWDXCW, is looming, and dagnabbit, does anybody really say that? The sun is not cooperating. Tad Cook, K7RA in Seattle, reports new sunspots appeared on November 14th and 16th, but solar activity was lower, as was geomagnetic activity. Average daily sunspot numbers declined from 36.4 last week to 30.9 in the November 11th through the 17th reporting week. Predicted solar flux averages will hover around 80 into early December. Space weatherwoman Tamitha Scove, WX6SWW, offers her take on things. And keep in mind, sometimes space weather can change fast.
We've really kind of quieted down when it comes to solar flux. We're sitting in the high 80s right now, moving into the mid 80s, and likely it's going to stay like that easily through the end of this week and into next week before we start seeing more regions rotate into view that could actually boost that solar flux back up again. So amateur radio operators and emergency responders expect marginal radio propagation on Earth's day side.
Space weather woman Tamitha Scove, WX6SWW. GB102ZE and GB2ZE will be on December 1st through the 26th to mark the first personal message sent across the Atlantic Ocean from ham to ham on December 12, 1921. In Scotland that day was 2ZE Paul Godley, who went to the UK representing ARRL to attempt the test. The Androssen Scotland Area Crocodile Rock Amateur Group is handling this commemorative operation. With authorization from the U.S. Navy's Third Fleet Spectrum Manager, the battleship Iowa Amateur Radio Association, Incorporated, and the Iowa's Innovation and Engineering Team will activate the ship's legacy Navy NEPM call sign on December 7, 2021, 1600 to 2359 UTC, to commemorate Pearl Harbor Day. NEPM will transmit on 14.781.5 and listen on 14.343. And that's ARRL Audio News for Friday, November 19th, 2021. For a deeper dive into these stories and other amateur radio news, check the ARRL website, www.arrl.org, or subscribe to the ARRL letter via your ARRL website member profile. Let us know if you're listening by email to audionews, one word, at arrl.org. This past week, we heard from Joseph, KO4.